It is expected Majid will be released in February. 38 men will remain at Guantanamo. What is the Biden administration doing? Are they going to close Guantanamo?
I think they are supposedly working behind the scenes, but they need to do far more to ensure the safe release and transfer of all 38 detainees, including Majid Khan. And in his case, to be sent to a place where he's free, will have emotional, psychological support and connection to his family.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Bahar Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting application for a director of finance administration, also human resources manager. Check it out at democracynow.org. And stay with us throughout these 2 weeks. Democracy Now! Is your place for the UN Climate Summit and everywhere around the world. I'm Amy Goodman.
One day.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO.
Did you miss the Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon? No worries. You can go to kboo.fm/ACR to listen to the archived show. You can also snag a limited edition KBOO Afro-Caribbean and Reggae hoodie before November 20th to show your support for the music and the programming you love. Again, you can catch the Afro-Caribbean and Reggae Marathon and snag a limited edition hoodie at kboo.fm/ACR.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth exclusively on Pacifica Radio and its affiliate stations. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, mothers and grandmothers spearhead a movement that is successful at bringing to justice generals who implemented Argentina's dirty wars. The controversial discussion on trafficking in women. Who's being protected? Who is being persecuted and driven further underground? What is the relationship between criminalization and vulnerability to violence? Also, Canada, New Zealand, the U.S. and the U.K., the movement to decriminalize sex work. Where is the debate in the women's movement? Why is the Swedish model not the answer? We have a far-ranging discussion with women's rights activist Nina Lopez. She hails from Argentina and is now based in London, England. She is with Legal Action for Women and the English Collective of Prostitutes. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headline.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. President Biden and Pope Francis have wrapped up their meeting at the Vatican. The world's two most notable Roman Catholics discussed the COVID-19 pandemic, the climate crisis, and poverty. Afterwards, Biden gave the Pope a military coin, calling the pontiff a warrior for peace.
And you are the most significant warrior for peace I've ever met.
Lei è il guerriero più forte per la pace che io abbia mai incontrato.
And with your permission, I'd like to be able to give you a coin.
Their private meeting lasted about 75 minutes, according to the Vatican, an unusually long time for an audience with the pontiff. Before President Biden left for Europe, he announced he'd reach a historic framework with congressional Democrats on his sweeping, although scaled back, social and climate spending plan known as Build Back Better. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Biden asked the House to approve a separate $1 trillion infrastructure bill and indicated she would start the voting yesterday, but Pelosi abandoned that effort after leading House progressives said they wouldn't vote on the infrastructure bill until they had guarantees about the text of Build Back Better and that holdout Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema will vote for it in the Senate. Pramila Jayapal chairs the House Progressive Caucus.
We want to see the actual text because we don't want any confusion, misunderstandings. My understanding is that the framework is very general. So let's turn it into legislative text. If 90% of the text is already written, as the Speaker has said, then it should be very quick. We can do it anywhere from 2 to 7 days. We should be able to get it done.
Following Biden's announcement, Sinema said she looked forward to getting this done. Manchin was less committal, saying this is all in the hands of the House right now. Protesters gathered in the heart of London's historic financial district to put pressure on banks to stop financing fossil fuel projects. Their action came ahead of the start of the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow. The protests are part of a worldwide day of action before leaders begin the UN Climate Conference known as COP26 on Sunday. Many climate justice activists are calling the nearly two-week-long climate meeting the world's last chance to turn the tide in the battle against climate catastrophe. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres echoed that warning.
But let's be clear. There is a serious risk that Glasgow will not deliver. Even if recent pledges were clear and credible, and there are serious questions about some of them, we are still careening towards climate catastrophe.
ExxonMobil is reporting a hefty profit for its third quarter, $6.75 billion for the latest three-month period. The profit report came a day after the chair and CEO of ExxonMobil and the other top oil giants were grilled by House Democratic lawmakers about the lies, deceptions, and lobbying that delayed action on the climate crisis for decades. Silicon Valley Congressman Ro Khanna chairs the House subcommittee which held the hearing. He pointed to lobbying by the American Petroleum Institute underway now against methane rules and subsidies for electric vehicles. Khanna asked each of the oil company executives to tell the API, which they fund, to stop that lobbying. When no one responded, he pressed the Shell executive.
You're funding these groups. And they're really having an impact. You know, they're spending millions of dollars in Congress, and you could do something here. You could tell them to knock it off for the sake of the planet. You could end it. You could end that lobbying. Would any of you take the opportunity to look at API and say, stop it? Any of you? Will you commit to, could you commit? Any of you? Would Ms. Watkins, come on. I mean, will you do something here? Would you commit to saying you're not going to fund any group that's going to engage in climate disinformation, at least?
Chairman Khanna, what I'll commit to is continuing to be an active member of the API. And we discuss many issues in API, some of which have to do with climate policy.
If the U.S. Supreme Court overturns the 1973 landmark Roe v. Wade decision, which legalized abortion around the country, California could see a nearly 3,000% increase in out-of-state residents seeking abortions here. That's according to a new report by the Guttmacher Institute. It estimates 26 states are likely to ban abortions if they get the go-ahead from the Supreme Court. The study predicts 1.4 million people will drive to California for the procedure. The study says most of them will be from neighboring Arizona. Workers at three Starbucks stores in Buffalo, New York will hold union elections next month after winning their case before the National Labor Relations Board. If that effort is successful, the stores would be the first of Starbucks' 8,000 company-owned shops to unionize. I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we're happy to have an in-studio guest, Nina Lopez. Nina, welcome.
Delighted to be here.
Nina Lopez is from Argentina. She's now based in London. She coordinates the work of the Global Women's Strike on Latin America, which includes women in the grassroots revolution in Venezuela and domestic workers in Peru. She is part of the Global Women's Strike Haiti Working Group, founder of Legal Action for Women, a grassroots legal service. She works with the English Collective of Prostitutes and Women Against Rape, and campaigns against the criminalization of women, including immigrant women, for justice and resources. She is coordinating the international launch of the new petition to all governments for a living wage for mothers and other caregivers, and she co-edited, along with her colleague Selma James, the brand new book, Ujamaa.
Yes, Ujamaa, the hidden story of Tanzania's socialist villages.
Well, Nina, you're usually off in London, so sure. We want to welcome you to Pacifica Studios. So let's start off with that.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. I think the last time I was here must have been about 14 years ago, something ridiculous.
That's so
I'm
outrageous.
I'm very, very pleased to be here.
That's got to change.
Yes.
You're coming back next month, right?
Okay.
Okay. Nina, you do hail from Argentina. A lot of our listeners may know Argentina as the place that Che Guevara hailed from, right? But there's been an incredible history in Argentina. Some of our listeners would know about the so-named Dirty War that went on in Argentina. I want you to tell us what you would like to share with us, what you know about that Dirty War. It was a military government, wasn't it? Around
yes.
74 to 83,
yes, yes.
Somewhere
it was
in there.
It was a military government from 1976 to 1983, and it was a horrendous. It was not the first military government that Argentina had ever had. I grew up on the number of military dictatorships, but this one was extraordinarily brutal, and 30,000 people were disappeared under this military government, and it was really a reign of terror. And the most extraordinary thing that happened under this government is that women organized. You know, the mothers of the disappeared, the Madres de Plaza de Mayo, and the grandmothers organized to find out what had happened to their children and to their grandchildren. First, the children, because it was largely young people that were taken by the military. But then they also found out that a number of the women who had disappeared had been pregnant at the time. You know, sometimes their mothers knew, sometimes they didn't know. And so it kind of emerged that about 500 children had been born to pregnant women while the mothers were in captivity. The mothers were then killed, and the grandmothers campaigned to find out what had happened to their grandchildren and have been able to recover about a quarter of them have reappeared. They have found out. They have found them, which has been an extraordinary victory, including last year, the grandchild of the mother who started the Grandmothers of Plaza de Mayo but had not herself found her grandchild. He emerged last year, you know, which was, as you can imagine,
a
very emotional. She found her grandchild. So there's about 117 children who are now in about their 40s, you know, who have been found. So it's been an extraordinary campaign by women.
Right. Tell us about that campaign. A lot of our listeners would not be familiar with it. The Grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo, founded in 1977, was it?
Yes.
Tell us a bit about that campaign,
right,
and what they did, because they had regular protests, didn't they?
Well, you know, what they did is that, first of all, there were these mothers who were desperate to find out what had happened to their children, because there would have been raids, you know, and then the children were taken. These were young people in their early 20s, sometimes teenagers, sometimes they. And there were all kinds of people. You know, there were people who were organizers of some sort, you know, who were, I mean, there were some people who were in armed struggle, but many others were trade unionists, student organizers, community organizers, you know, all kinds of people. And they were just taken, and then the mothers didn't know what to do. So they started turning up at every police station they could think of to find out, where is my daughter, where is my son? And then they saw that when they turned up at the police stations, there would be other mothers like themselves who were also trying to find their children. And little by little, a group formed. And they decided to demonstrate in front of Government House in Plaza de Mayo, which is why they're called the Madres de Plaza de Mayo, the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo. And they would just go around, you know, the monument there. And they just walked around. And in order to recognize each other, they wore a white handkerchief on their heads. And little by little, more and more mothers joined, you know, this demonstration. Every Thursday they went around. And then other people who were supporting their movement also joined. And if any one group can be said to have brought the military dictatorship down, it is them. They definitely spearheaded that campaign. They were not the only ones. You know, the movement grew. But they were fearless, you know, and three of the founders of the Madre de Plaza de Mayo, were themselves disappeared. And the man who caused their disappearance was tried and is now in jail. You know, a man called Estes, they called him the Angel of Death. He pretended to be the brother of somebody who had disappeared to gain their, you know,
their confidence.
And then disappeared three of them. You know, he was a military
right.
man.
Right, and placed in there.
That's right.
Likely to do a job.
That's right.
Yeah, and, you know, for people to understand what being disappeared means, there were apparently clandestine detention centers, I guess, sort of like these sites, as they're called now,
there
were torture centers.
There were torture centers all over the country, but there is a very famous one, which is called the ESMA, which is the military school in Buenos Aires, where about 5,000 of the 30,000 disappeared went through that torture center. In fact, including my brother-in-law was held there. And they just killed people. And many people also died. They were taken on a plane, and they were then dropped alive, you know, into the Rio de la Plata, you know, the big river near Buenos Aires. They were just dropped in the Rio de la Plata in the ocean, and a lot of people died that way. But the extraordinary thing is that as a result of this movement that was started by the mothers and then the grandmothers, there have been trials of the military in Argentina and that have gone on over the years. And the trial, there's a massive ESMA trial, you know, against the people responsible for the disappearances at the military school, which is taking place right now. And it's the third ESMA trial. And to this date, over 400 military people have been convicted, you know, of human rights murders and violations of all sorts. And it's not only the heads of the dictatorship who were all tried and convicted, but a whole set of other layers, you know, were also convicted. And that, I think, is kind of unprecedented because,
you know, I've never heard of that.
That's the point. You hear a lot about truth and reconciliation in South Africa. And in Argentina, we actually got some justice. And we're still getting some justice. And in fact, what the movement, you know, the slogans of the movement are memory, truth, and justice. And another big slogan that's always used is ni olvido ni perdón. You know, we won't forget and we won't forgive. And the movement has gone for justice and has been able to achieve justice to a large degree. And I think it's really important that people all over the world should know that you can win. You know, nobody had more power than the Argentinian military when they were in power. I mean, they had supreme power of life and death over the population. And despite that, we are now in a position where hundreds of them have been tried and have been convicted. And in fact, the head of the military junta died in prison. And we all rejoiced not only that he had died, but that he had died in prison. You know, and it's really important that people should know that. And the biggest ESMA trial that's going on at the moment, some of the people who are being tried for the murder of a couple of French nuns who were disappeared, for a number of children who were disappeared, for a very famous journalist, Roberta Walsh, who was also disappeared. And some of them are pilots. You know, they are the pilots of those planes that the victims were thrown out of to their death. So it's really an important moment. And also, when the democracy returned in 83 and 84, they tried some of the military then, but then soon after they passed immunity laws so that those convictions were overturned. And it was only and they were called, which is very telling, because one of them was called punto final, which means like full stop, like from now on, nobody can be tried anymore. And the other law that was passed was called obediencia debida, which means due obedience. So it was what the Nuremberg trials were about, that you could not justify what you had done by saying you were following orders. That was the law that was passed in Argentina to give immunity to the military. So they could say, well, I was told to do these things and I did them. And those laws were overturned as a result of really a massive movement for justice led by women in 2003. And from then on, the trials started again. So for the past 12 years, there have been trials against the military.
Okay. Just breaking this down a bit further, you talked about South Africa and truth and reconciliation, and you talked about the theme of memory, truth, and justice. A difference here. And the truth and reconciliation is just popularized. Recently we were in Ferguson. You were there.
That's
part
right.
of the delegation,
yes.
With me and Selma James and others. There are many places you go to. People around Haiti have talked about it. Places where atrocities happen.
That's
people
right.
look to that process in South Africa, truth and reconciliation and peace. We all get over it and then just move on together. This movement in Argentina has been markedly different. Tell us the importance of that, and why do you think this is less known than truth and reconciliation? People have tried to say truth, justice, and reconciliation as a way of moving it in the right direction.
Well, I think the movement always wants justice. I think when we have suffered an injustice, whatever that is, whether it's rape or the murder of a loved one, I think what we always want is justice, and that's always what we campaign for. But the state generally doesn't want justice, because usually they're the ones who are implicated. Either they have committed the injustice themselves, as is the case in a dictatorship, or they have allowed it, as is very often in rape cases, for example. So they're not interested in justice. They're interested in moving us along, right? So that we have to somehow accept that, okay, this is now over and you have to learn to live with it.
Everything is normalized.
That's right. And in Argentina, I suppose it was just the strength of the movement. They couldn't do that. And as a result of it, we have won justice, at least to a large degree. And I think the reason why it's not known is precisely because the media generally around the world doesn't want people to know that justice is not something that you can aspire for. It's something you can actually win. And that there are countries where this has happened and Argentina is one. And the government in Argentina has backed that movement for justice, which is why, when the Kirchners came to power and all that, and in 2003, they abolished those laws that gave impunity to the military so that the trials could proceed. And the movement never stopped to be on the street, to go to the trials, to be forever present. The mothers and the grandmothers and everybody else and the children also have carried on with it. It's been really a mass movement, and it has really focused on memory, justice, memory and justice.
A mass movement initiated by mothers.
That's right. Really spearheaded by mothers and then grandmothers. By both. The mothers who wanted justice for their children and the grandmothers who wanted to find their grandchildren and who have been able to, as I said, to find about a quarter of those that disappeared, which is extraordinary, really extraordinary. And one of the ways in which they won is that they made it international. from very early on, they started, you know, they started in 1977. By 1978, they were traveling abroad because they couldn't get anywhere in Argentina. You know, the media was complete censorship. Their lives were at stake. Three of them had been disappeared themselves. They went abroad. And they publicized what was happening in Argentina. They even used the World Cup, which happened in 1978. There was a big world football World Cup in Argentina, which the military was trying to use to get good publicity for themselves. And they just used everything they could to let the world know this is what you're hearing is not the truth. This is what's going on. And they got support. They got support in Spain. They got support in Italy. They got support in places where there was an Argentinian, you know, a lot of Argentinians are maybe of Spanish descent or Italian descent. So they went to those countries and they said, there is some of your citizens who have dual citizenship who have been disappeared and you should want to know about that.
Mm-hmm.
And they really mobilized. So they used the international. And South Africa, of course, did too with the anti-apartheid movement. You know, they used the international when the situation at home was really difficult.
Yeah, and that brings to mind stories. I mean, here in the United States, you see an anti-lynching campaigner like Ida B. Wells. Also, similarly, went
That's
abroad,
right.
got
right.
international support, and actually when she came back in her particular area, lynchings had actually disappeared. I mean, now we know they haven't really disappeared, given
That's
what
right.
is happening today. But I just wanted to fast forward that in a bit. I mean, this is a victory happening now in Argentina, but that international connection, we talk a bit about this on the show, that it's very difficult when you have a local struggle, a local situation, you keep it local and you don't go for that international support. We see Malcolm X going abroad and getting international support. We also
That's
see
right.
Martin Luther King going abroad and getting international support. And it
yeah.
does seem as though it was exactly at those particular moments that they then came under such attack and were killed. I mean, certainly with Malcolm X's case, it was. So there's a whole critique now going on with movements happening here in the United States that people remain very focused on the United States and don't make those kinds of international connections. I've heard you make mention of this point in relation to how the war in Iraq is viewed, for example, and the millions
yes.
of people killed there. So Argentina has shown that it is vital to
That's
win,
right.
isn't it?
Yes, it is absolutely vital. And as you mentioned, we were in Ferguson just recently, and it was really... it was really such an education to see what they have been organizing there, especially the women. You know, they've had these meetings of mother to mother where the black women, the black mothers were telling the white mothers what it is like to raise your children with the kind of racist police that they're facing and to not know if your child is going to be alive by the time he goes to school and comes back. You know, the terror that women are living under. And one of the things they mentioned was that at the peak of the demonstrations there, they got support from the Palestinians in Gaza. And the woman who was telling this story, you could see that it was an absolute revelation to her. The fact that people in Gaza who had suffered so much, you know, such a 2,000 of them, over 2,000 of them victims of the bombing from Israel and all of that, that they should be concerned with what was happening to women and children and everyone, to the black community in Ferguson, was an absolute eye-opener. And I think was a big education because she just saw that what she was up against was bigger than Ferguson. It wasn't even just the whole of the United States, but it's what's happening all around the world. And coming from Britain, we've had quite a lot of death in custody. You know, we had Jean-Charles de Menezes, who was shot supposedly for being a terrorist. It then turned out he was a Brazilian.
Shot by whom?
By the police.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they put 7 or 8 bullets into his head when he was on the underground. Okay, just
this
like
is in
that.
The UK.
That was in the UK. They just said, well, they decided he must be a terrorist and it was a mistake, and they just killed him. They didn't even ask him a single word, nothing. He was asked nothing. So, that, you know, this is going on all around. I mean, we've had, you know, we've had in England where I live, I mean, there's, you know, the women there are campaigning for justice as well. And it's been very hard to get a single policeman responsible for a shooting convicted or even tried. It's been absolutely very, very difficult. Or people who are being deported, for example, there was a famous case of Jimmy Mubenga, which the women from our Women's Center organized about. The man was killed as he was being deported. You know, he was held down and he couldn't breathe. I can't breathe. That's what he was saying. I can't breathe. And even though people on the plane tried to intervene, some of them, he was killed, and the people who killed him were found not guilty in a trial. You know, it was absolutely horrendous.
Right. Our guest in studio is Nina Lopez, originally from Argentina, now based in London, England. We're having a wide-ranging discussion with Nina. We spoke earlier about a victory in Argentina where the mothers and grandmothers of the disappeared were actually able to find some of their grandchildren who had been disappeared, but also hundreds of members of the military responsible for these disappearances being brought to trial.
That's
and
right.
Them winning some justice and the international connection. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And we are going to take a brief station break, but we are going to continue our discussion with Nina Lopez, hails from Argentina, now based in London, England. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Sojourner Truth. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. If you've missed any part of this hour, go to our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, like and friend us on Facebook. And generally, we like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in different cities and countries around the world. And today, why don't we do a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in London, England. And our guest in studio, Nina Lopez, hails from Argentina, now based in London. She coordinates the work of the Global Women's Strike in Latin America. Many of you know that I'm actively involved with women of color in the Global Women's Strike, so she is indeed a colleague in my work and in the community level, and which includes women in the grassroots revolution in Venezuela, domestic workers in Peru, the Global Women's Strike Haiti Working Group. She is a founder of Legal Action for Women, which is based in London, and we're going to find out a bit more about that. It's a grassroots legal service. She also works with the English Collective of Prostitutes and Women Against Rape and other campaigns against the criminalization of women, including immigrant women, for justice and resources. She's also coordinating the international launch of the new petition to all governments for a living wage for mothers and other caregivers. So we're covering quite a lot of ground here today, Nina. That's why we're glad to have you in studio. Let us shift focus a bit now to talk about your work with legal action for women, and specifically with the English Collective of Prostitutes. You, as you know, I have been involved, a founder of the Black Coalition Fighting Back Serial Murders, around the murders of Black women in South Los Angeles, disregarded criminal neglect by law enforcement. The film Grim Sleeper, appearing on HBO, covers some of our work. But certainly at the beginning of the coalition, and when we, in the mid to late 80s, when all of this was happening, we consulted with the English Collective of Prostitutes because you all had been dealing with a case of a serial killer. The Yorkshire Ripper at the time, and certainly that was very helpful to us. And you also organized protests in London demanding justice for the women in the Black women in South Los Angeles. That was a tremendous boost for our work. So tell us first about Legal Action for Women and what you do there, and then we'll get into a discussion about issues surrounding sex workers in the English Collective.
Well, you know, Legal Action for Women, which has a sister group, in fact, in San Francisco, was started in about 1982, and I was the first coordinator. And it's a grassroots legal service, and it was started by the English Collective of Prostitutes, because we were facing a situation there where women were being arrested, sex workers were being arrested, whether or not they were working. Our women's center was in a red light area, and in fact, you were there at the time, Margaret, when we then occupied the church to protest against police racism, illegality, and racism against sex workers. A lot of the women who worked in that area were Black women, and they were particularly targeted by the police. And we were fighting so many cases because women would come to our women's center and at the time to get help with their legal case. Some of them were threatened with having their children taken away. A woman had been raped, and instead of the police going after her rapist, they decided to arrest her boyfriend because he was Black and she was white. And so they assumed that he was a pimp, which was nothing of the sort. So that's the kind of situation that we were up against. And we decided to go and seek sanctuary in the local church, which was just a block away from our women's center. We had intended to stay for one night, but once we were there, there was a lot of power in being in a church, being protected from the police, and actually having the interest of the media who wanted to know what the hell we were doing in the church and why we were there. So we were there for 12 days, to cut a long story short. We just slept overnight. And we got a huge amount of support from the local community, from gay men who also were up against the police at the time, and, you know, who came and brought food. We had meetings in the church. And some of the authorities, Tony Benn and his wife Caroline in particular, who were the best, because they didn't come to give us advice. Some of them would come and lecture us, you know, about women's oppression and all that. But Tony Benn and his wife Caroline came and said, "How can we help?" They really identified.
And at the time, Tony Benn was
a member of parliament.
Member of parliament,
yeah. And a very famous member of parliament. And he just wanted to help, you know, which so he dictated a letter to the government saying this is what's going on, et cetera, et cetera. And it was it really put the policing of prostitute women on the political agenda in a way that had never been discussed before. And I remember at the time that some of the journalists said, "Oh, you'll never get the word police illegality in the press." You know, because we will never accuse the police of committing illegalities, even though they all knew that police often committed illegalities.
Yeah.
But we did. We did get it in the press. And now everybody discusses police illegality and all forms of corruption, racism, sexism, you name it. The police are so discredited. So it was really a first. And Legal Action for Women took off from there. You know, it took off from sex workers needing legal support. But from the beginning, it was open to all women, and immigrant women were a very big part of the work we did, you know, women who were facing deportation. And now it's, God, we do so many things. We've just fought massive raids in the red light area of Soho, where women mainly work indoors.
And these are sex workers.
Sex workers, and the police were trying to shut those flats. They shut the flats, and as a result of the
apartments.
And they, as a result of the work of Legal Action for Women and the English Collective of Prostitutes, all but one were reopened, which was a massive victory. And we do also a lot of cases of women who work on the street who are then accused of antisocial behavior, because often they don't necessarily arrest you for a prostitution offense. They arrest you for some form of antisocial behavior, which is absurd. And it's a way of bypassing the legal process, really, because you don't really need
that
any
evidence.
That
could mean anything.
Exactly, and you don't need any evidence. Just the word of a policeman is enough. So we do a lot of those cases, and we do a lot of immigration, asylum. You know, we have a big group of asylum seekers at our center called the All African Women's Group. We have very successfully fought a lot of cases, and it's all based on self-help. So we don't fight for people. We fight with people. We say, look, there's a lot that can be done. Let's work together and do it. And if people are ready to fight, we're always ready to help.
Right. So certainly a tremendous history there, and publications as well in terms of helping people to know what their rights are, how to fight cases, et cetera.
Yeah, we just put out a self-help guide, in fact, for asylum seekers, which has just been published. 10,000 copies. A donor has paid for 10,000 copies so that they can go to every detention center and to every asylum seeker.
Right. And, of course, people putting that in the context of the United States, that would be the immigrant community, in particular those who are seeking asylum from another country, but also just generally people who are immigrants and trying to find their way and get their rights. Our guest is in studio is Nina Lopez. She is based now in London, England. She hails originally from Argentina. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Nina, you talked about the church occupation, and I was glad to be there.
Yes,
got quite a training
you
at,
and your
at the
daughter.
Time. Yeah, she was just a baby at the
and
time. I remember
son.
There were several babies. I think there were three babies
That's
who
right.
were at that church occupation, all breastfeeding, by the way.
That's right.
And Legal Action for Women. Now, I want to fast forward a bit because there is a raging discussion going on now on the whole issue of trafficking. And there are just a lot of discussion in terms of how trafficking laws have been used against vulnerable women on the one hand, including sex workers, and in England, but as well as in the United States, women who are immigrant. And on the other hand, women who are truly trafficked, that then who may be domestic workers, who may be work in factories, who then don't get the protection and help that they need, and also the fact that the laws that are already on the books in terms of kidnapping, coercion, et cetera, are not being used. So there's a lot of confusion has developed around the issue of trafficking, and people have kind of dug in terms of their position. I wanted you to talk a little bit about your work with the English Collective of Prostitutes and in that whole discussion on trafficking, shed some light on us so that people out there can really get a handle on what's going on.
Well, as you said, trafficking has really been used as an excuse to increase police powers against sex workers. And the raids that I just mentioned in Soho against the women who worked indoors in the red light area of Soho, which is right in central London, and it's a very, very old red light area. Those raids, the excuse for them was that supposedly there were women and children who had been trafficked and who were working there. Now, some of the statistics that have been used by some feminists who are very anti-trafficking and are basing themselves on what we call in England the Swedish model, and I'll explain about that in a moment. The statistics that they have used are completely fabricated. And basically, if you're an immigrant,
just made up.
Pretty much. If you're an immigrant, you're assumed to have been trafficked. which is just outrageous. Because, first of all, since the European borders have been open with the European Union and all that, there are a lot of women who are coming from Romania, from Poland, from all over Eastern Europe, who have every legal right to be in Britain. And many of them end up in the sex industry because they can't get another job. You know, if you don't speak the language, etc., sometimes it's very difficult to get another job. And if you have to choose between domestic work, between, you know, being a cleaner somewhere or being a sex worker, sex work pays more. And often it does happen that women, not necessarily from Europe but from elsewhere, have had to pay somebody to get them there. You know, there's, I don't know if you're aware, but there are a lot of thousands and thousands of people who have died coming from Libya and from Syria, yeah, et cetera, across, you know, across the seas to get to Italy in particular. And, you know, too many people on the boats and people have drowned in their hundreds. I mean, it's been absolutely horrendous. And those people often pay somebody to bring them across.
Yeah.
And so that becomes that you have been trafficked, but it doesn't mean that you didn't want to come across. It just meant that you had to end up paying somebody to bring you there. And so that is the first definition of trafficking that becomes blurred and completely a complete misrepresentation. But the fact is that in all the raids that they have done of sex workers in Britain, they have not found women who have been trafficked. And it's been absolutely scandalous because we, at our women's center, we have had women who had been trafficked who came to us for help and who could not get help. They could not get housing. They could not get the men arrested who had actually forced them into prostitution or some other form of labor. It's not that it doesn't go on. They just recently raided some nail parlors and supposedly found a whole set of women from Vietnam who had been trafficked. We don't know whether that's true or it's not true, but they probably didn't have papers and they probably were just undocumented workers.
Yeah, and I mean, the way that plays itself out here in the U.S., I mean, hold that thought, is that everybody knows that to get over the U.S. border, people often pay what's called a coyote,
exactly,
somebody to help them get across the border. And some of those people are very, you know, brutal, right?
Exactly.
And don't treat the people very well that who have paid them good money
That's
to get
right.
them across the border, may leave them to die in the desert or whatever. So it would be as saying that everybody who then crosses the U.S. border illegally,
that's right,
and has had help in doing that have been trafficked.
Exactly, exactly, absolutely. And what we have been saying is that if they are women who are truly trafficked, as in they are forced to work in prostitution or in any other kind of
against their will,
that they should get an assurance that they will not be deported back to the country they came from, because usually they don't want to go back there. Usually it's either a situation of war that women are escaping or some violence or tremendous poverty. And so women don't want to go back. They want to stay and they want to be able to support their families from where they are and to get the protection that they should be entitled to. But of course, the government has absolutely refused not to deport women, because really what they're using the anti-trafficking legislation is for deportation purposes.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's the same here. I think it's the same all around the world. You know, the other thing about trafficking is that it was under George Bush that trafficking became a big international push, and that countries, governments, were judged by the U.S. government by what they were doing against trafficking. And so everybody got lined up, as the governments tend to do, you know, salute whatever the American policy is. And everybody got lined up to prove that they were really doing a lot against trafficking.
And that brings in the NGOs. There's a lot of money in it, isn't there?
A lot of money has gone into supporting NGOs.
Non-governmental organizations.
When AIDS was the big issue, a lot of money went into AIDS. When trafficking became the big issue, a lot of money got poured into trafficking. So all these NGOs then are created or start projects to deal with trafficking. And another issue that we have had in Britain is the so-called Swedish model.
Yeah, what is that, the Swedish model?
Yeah, because you're not so familiar with it here, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens is that Sweden used to have, prostitution didn't used to be criminal in Sweden. Then they changed the law and they made it criminal for men to purchase sexual services. Okay, some years ago.
Criminalized the clients.
They criminalized the clients, but in fact, what has happened is that the ones who have been most affected have been the sex workers, because they've had to basically go underground in order to be able to make a living.
And be more vulnerable to violence.
More vulnerable to violence, more vulnerable to all kinds of repression and stigma. You know, prostitution was largely not stigmatized in Sweden, and it now is. So that there are now cases of women who are losing their children because they're sex workers, other women who have problems with domestic violence, etc., who just cannot come forward because they can no longer count on the police to protect them. So it's been a really very bad situation, but it has been promoted internationally.
Equality.
Equality for women that, you know, that is bad for men to be clients, and therefore we should just stop it. And it hasn't stopped prostitution. Because there are many reasons, economic reasons, you know, why women in particular end up working as prostitutes. So it hasn't stopped it. And what we have been campaigning for, both in England and here with the U.S. Prostitutes Collective, our sister organization in San Francisco, is to decriminalize prostitution based on the New Zealand model, which decriminalized years ago and which has been very successful. And, you know, they completely ignore New Zealand because they didn't want to do that. So you never heard about it until we really, through campaigning, put it on the agenda. And we have now reached a point where, you know, some people that are, some politicians have actually told us that they're ready to look at New
What's
Zealand.
What's the difference with the New Zealand model?
Well,
and
New
the
Zealand
Swedish
is
model.
Completely decriminalized. And so that. Basically, you have the same rights as any other worker. And a few people are allowed to work together without requiring licenses and all that. So you can work as a small collective. If it's a bigger establishment, then you need a license, as you would if you're any kind of business. And it has meant that sex workers can report violence to the police. The police are now obliged to take action as opposed to criminalize the sex worker. And that the stigma has largely gone. It's not perfect, obviously, and there are people who are trying to bring back criminalization. But it has been very successful, and it has certainly been the most successful model, if you want to call it that, in the world.
Our guest is Nina Lopez. She is based in London, England, originally from Argentina, active on a number of campaigners on women's rights and anti-racism, including legal action for women. We're talking now about her work with the English Collective of Prostitutes and discussing trafficking. This is Margaret Prescott, a host of Sojourner Truth. You know, recently a controversy broke out because there is a journalist and a writer, very well known, stands against the war, supported the California prisoner hunger strike. They came out and basically made a case that all prostitution is trafficking or some form of slavery. I don't remember the exact quote, but I remember seeing the article and knowing that a number of sex workers, including from the U.S. Prostitutes Collective, were quite upset by it and quite disappointed in that. But there is this kind of conflation now going, looking at women's rights, to say that sex work is a particular form of exploitation. It really is. Some people are saying it is trafficking, whether or not you agree to be a sex worker or not. I just wanted to get a quick response from you on that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because all the sex worker organizations around the world, no matter what country you're talking about, are campaigning for decriminalization. And I think before people pass judgment on how other workers view themselves, they should really listen to those workers. And it's really outrageous that it's women who claim to be feminists who are themselves the first to totally ignore what sex workers have to say for themselves. It's just really shocking. It's like they think they know best. They think you are a victim, but you're not aware that you're a victim, and that they, who know what's good for you, are going to make decisions, you know, for your life and what's good for you. I mean, it's just such a piece of discrimination against women applied by other women who are usually in professional jobs or who are politicians, etc. So it's completely outrageous. But I think we are winning. I think times are changing, and I think increasingly the public is in favor of decriminalization, and I think that's true in the U.S. as it is in Britain. They've done opinion polls in Britain. The majority of people want prostitution decriminalized, mainly on grounds of safety, because they do feel that sex workers will be safer if it's decriminalized than if it isn't. So it's very important. You know, the other issue, of course, it's economic. You know, we have faced, and you've faced here in the U.S. as well, massive austerity policies where people have been driven to destitution. And that has especially affected women. It has especially affected single mothers. And the idea that in a climate like that, you're going to be criminalizing women for trying to support themselves and their families is just absolutely outrageous. You know, we've all resorted to, we have always in history resorted to prostitution in order to feed our children, if that's all there was.
Right. And then there's also the stereotype of, well, the sex worker on drugs with a pimp, right? And it always seemed to me as though you're not looking at people who are on drugs in other industries, whether they're football players. Well, some of that is coming out right
doctors,
whether they're baseball players. Recently in St. Louis, one of the white suburbs, one of the mothers was saying that is known as a meth capital in the U.S., and you're now finding addiction spreading out, crack and heroin and other addiction in Maine. The governor declared a crisis, etc. So that, you know, just say a little bit about that as well, because that has also been a kind of a stereotyping of who sex workers are.
Well, I think, we always say that at least 70% of sex workers are mothers, you know, trying to support themselves and their families. And I think that is still true. I think also there are a lot of young people who go into prostitution to either support themselves because they're homeless or because they're students and they have to pay, you know, they don't have a grant and they have to pay for their education. I think that's also very common. But a lot of them are also young men, you know, homeless. If you're homeless, asylum seekers who are not allowed the right to work. And
Transgender
people. I mean, transgender. If you're a transgender, you're so discriminated in employment that the only job you can get is to work in the sex industry.
Right.
That is very common here. It's very common in Europe. So it's, some people have called it a survival tactic. And why we should be criminalized for our poverty. Now, of course, some people would rather be a sex worker than do other jobs, and that's fine too. I mean, what is wrong? U.S. Yes, I have mentioned the U.S. Prostitutes Collective.
Yes,
we do campaign together, and we campaign also for compensation, so that if sex workers have been raped, you can get compensation, which on both sides of the Atlantic, we're often denied compensation because we are either, in England they call it your character and conduct, means that you have contributed to the crime against you if you have been raped by a client, for example, and therefore you're denied compensation. Or with the U.S. Prostitutes Collective here recently, there was a massive victory where a regulation was overturned as a result of very successful campaigning by us pros and some other sex worker organizations, so that sex workers now can claim compensation if they have been raped, but it has to be extended to other sectors. You know, if you have a criminal conviction or you've been to jail, for example, you wouldn't be allowed to apply.
Right.
So there's a lot of work to be done.
There is, and a lot more that we have to talk about, but sadly yes. We are out of time, so we're going to have to continue this conversation. Our guest, Nina Lopez, originally from Argentina, now based in London, England, a women's rights activist. There's so much we didn't get to talk about. Your co-editing of the Ujamaa book, The Living Wage for Mothers and Other Caregivers campaign, but we're going to follow up. We appreciate you coming into studio.
Thank you, Margaret. It's been a pleasure to be here in person rather than at the other end of a phone. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. We're out of time. I would like to thank our guest, Nina Lopez. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
Je revois la ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule et la foule vient me jeter entre ses bras. Emporté par la foule qui nous entraîne, écrasés l'un contre l'autre, nous ne formons qu'un seul corps. Et le flot sans effort nous pousse enchaîner l'un et l'autre, et nous laisse tous deux épanouis, enivrés et heureux. Entraînés par la foule qui s'élance et qui danse une folle farandole, nos deux mains restent soudées. Et parfois soulever nos deux corps enlacés s'envolent et retombent tous deux épanouis, enivrés et heureux. Et la joie qu'elle a poussée par son sourire me transperce et rejaillit au fond de mon âme.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Muertos PDX on Tuesday, November 2nd from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. streaming online. Muertos PDX is a virtual Dia de Muertos celebration featuring cultural dances, poetry readings, musical performances, and altars to honor loved ones who have passed. Again, that's Muertos PDX, a virtual Dia de Muertos celebration on Tuesday, November 2nd from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m., streaming online. More information can be found on kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.